On show 107, what you should be learning about in 2008, Jason Beard on web design basics and how to deal with portfolio pages.
Welcome to
BloatWorld.com. The podcast for those involved in designing, developing and running websites.
This is what everybody waits for.
Hello and welcome to Boag World, the podcast for all those involved in designing, developing and running websites on a daily basis. My name's Paul Boag.
And my name is Marcus Lillington.
Hooray!
Our last show.
Yeah, your last show this week, because you're going to be famous any minute now. Oh, by the way, that reminds me. Nothing. Actually, it doesn't remind me.
There's no link here.
At all, but something just popped into my head. I am receiving emails saying, when are we going to see Marcus's tidy office? And as this is your last week, you need to get on.
It is tidy. Well, it's kind of... It's nearly tidy.
You said it was going to be tidied over Christmas.
Well, that's when I did it. But I've still got a big pile of paper that I need to sort out. You know, sort of about so big.
So that doesn't work well on an audio podcast. What's about a foot?
A bit more than that, really.
Bit more than
a foot and a half, I would have said.
Yeah, I'm not very good with old measurements.
Well, all right, okay. Metric?
I'm not very good with metric either. What, 70 centimetres maybe?
Yeah, maybe about that. I don't know. No, not quite that much, I would have said.
Oh, wouldn't you?
We are definitely going off on a pointless tangent now.
This is really, yeah.
I need to sort all my audio stuff underneath my desk because it's still nasty wiring.
Okay.
Horrid. And I've got this big pile of paper. Otherwise, it is immaculate.
I believe you.
I'll take a picture. I can take a photograph when I go home today.
Well, thousands wouldn't. Of course, any minute now, you could actually be completely wireless because there's a lot of rumours going around. Mm-hmm. Or actually, by the time this podcast goes out, we'll know. But you're talking about when we go to South by Southwest, you're going to buy a Mac, right?
Yeah, probably.
That's the rumour.
Mm-hmm.
But so
they're still really cheap compared to UK.
Yes, which I'm sure they will be. Although the exchange rate is slightly not quite as good as it was from what I've seen.
It might be just back to kind of boringly normal by then.
Yes, but it's still a hell of a lot cheaper than buying it over here. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so there's a keynote that's happening this afternoon, which probably, I don't know when we're going to release this podcast, but may have already happened. And they're talking about a MacBook Air. It's one of the things which is super thin.
Does it fly?
Well, there's so many rumours.
Can you sit on it and fly?
There are so many rumours flying around about this thing.
Yeah, but it's going to cost a fortune, the MacBook Air.
Well, one of them was that it's going to be completely cableless. So even powering, it does that through magic.
How can you power something through
the air? It's amazing what ridiculous rumours. Oh, you can. Have you not seen these pad things? They're amazing. You just toss your mobile phone on it and it charges.
Ooh.
It's like
Well, right, say if you're at South by Southwest, for example, and there's a line of you all using MacBook Airs.
Power doesn't arc across the room and incinerate anybody that walks across its path.
So how does it work then, Paul?
I don't know. I don't even believe it. It's just one of the many rumours that are going around.
Okay.
So you're going to be a MacBook fanboy. Yes.
We'll see.
We'll be an all Mac podcast and that kind of ruins it, really. Because nobody else is interested. Anyway, so there we go. Also, the other thing is you still owe me 40 quid.
I do.
So there we go.
Mm-hmm. I wonder how long I can keep that up for.
Well, you
owing you 40 quid.
Well, you're not owing me 40 quid. You're owing orphan children 40 quid.
No, it's more fun thinking it's you, Paul.
Yes, I thought it would be. Okay, so let's move on to the news after that slightly rambling introduction. So, let's talk news, shall we? I have to say, I've been a bit disappointed with the news recently. Things seem to have really slowed down. It's like nobody's blogging anymore.
It's January. Everyone hibernates.
Yeah, I think it is.
I'd like to hibernate. Yes. Can I hibernate, please, Paul?
No.
I feel absolutely knackered at the moment. I'm doing two jobs at the moment.
Well, that's because, as you were telling me earlier, you're trying to get out your album.
I know. It's like, that's during the night, and this is during the day. Hi, Paul.
You're not good. So, again, you're doing visual gags that don't work on the podcast.
Yeah, you can put, I don't know, little cartoons in the notes or something.
No.
And then Marcus did a silly face.
Yes. No, that's not going to happen. Yeah, so you're desperately trying to get your album out because you've got like 10 seconds of national coverage.
Yeah, and that's right. All we're ever going to get.
And you
ever.
Know they're going to edit out the name anyway.
It's a possibility, but unlikely. Because how can they do that, really? Unless they just, well, they always say so-and-so.
Yeah, don't they say things like, is still trying to have a pop career and things
usually,
like that?
Usually, yeah.
Yeah. So not, what is the name of your band? It's a really
Stroke the Toad.
Stroke the Toad. I thought it was Stoke the Toad.
Well, that kind of works.
Because I did a search on iTunes to see if you existed and you didn't.
Not on iTunes. We will as of Thursday.
I was amazed. You didn't even exist in your previous incarnation either. If you type in Marcus Linton, it doesn't come back with anything.
I know. That's a bit odd. I should fix that, really, shouldn't I?
It doesn't even come back with the Barrow World podcast. It should at least do that. I should make sure you're in there somewhere. I just make it all about me.
Anyway, it is all about you, Paul, isn't it?
How's this more relating intro to the news? Yeah, this is just more intro, dressed up as news.
Oh, shut up.
Our first news story today. No, you can't. I'm going to make you do the second news story.
No.
Our first news story today is an article on working with clients. Specifically, it focuses on the subject of setting your client expectations and clearly communicating with them. Let's face it, we all have to work with somebody, and okay, maybe not all of us have clients per se, but even if we work for kind of other companies, we still have managers and bosses and things like that, and we've kind of all been in that position where either our client or our boss has had the expectation of something that we are convinced we never promised to give them, so this is kind of relevant to everybody. And this article really looks at two ways of managing the kind of scenario of, you know, unrealistic expectations on behalf of the client. And the first point that they raise is one of being diligent up front. And as the article says, setting expectations isn't difficult or mysterious, but it does take time and you need to be diligent about it. And I think that's a very good point, really. I think communication, you kind of sometimes get so, you know, obsessed with getting the project out that you don't communicate properly, and that's where problems occur. Secondly, it suggests that you need to be consistent, and that doesn't mean that you're inflexible. It means that you need to be consistent in your communication throughout the project. If the project, you know, the goalposts move, it's important that you explain the ramifications of that. And the principles of this article really kind of apply universally to everybody. So whoever you are, take a few minutes to check it out. Definitely worth doing.
Not wanting to big you up at all, Paul, ever. Mm-hmm.
Right.
But I'm sure you've written an article similar to this.
Oh, yeah, almost certainly.
Yeah.
But that's true. I've written...
But
I've
there's no news at the moment, so...
Yeah. And also, it's good to get different people's perspective on
this.
Yeah,
I suppose.
And I've written about everything. I mean, if we only included stuff I didn't know about, there wouldn't be much in the show, would there?
Oh, dear. Excuse me.
Okay, the next post, he said, moving on quickly, I think falls into that category of it's funny because it's true. I don't think it's meant to be funny, but it is anyway. And it's a post by one of my favourite bloggers, a guy called Jerry McGovern, who seems to go off on this complete rant in his latest post about sites that seem to spend more time talking about their great user experience rather than actually offering a great user experience. And he begins his rant by focusing on welcome copy. You know, the things I'll read out what he says. He says, I don't want to pass meaningless pleasantries with your website. I don't want to shake its hand or talk about the weather. I'm at your website for a reason. I'm in a hurry. I'm impatient. So kill the welcome, please. You know, these websites that go, hello and welcome to, you know, Headscape's website or whatever. Well, I thought that was quite funny. Personally. Yeah. And then he also goes on to criticize sites that waste valuable copy, explaining how easy their sites are to use. He makes a comment, if it's really easy, why are you telling me it's really easy and quick? For starters, you're wasting my time by making me read meaningless sentences. Yeah, right. So he gets quite passionate in this particular post. And if you ever write copy for websites, then you should read it. It's definitely a good read. And even if you don't, to be honest, check it out, because it's always nice to hear somebody ranting for pure entertainment.
Absolutely.
Purposes. Okay, the final news story for today is really one that I came across on the web design wall, and I have to say it was posted before Christmas, but as I said, there's not a lot of news going around at the moment. And it's entitled the all-expanding box, or all-expandable box, should I say. And this solves a problem that I encounter quite regularly. As anybody that listens to this podcast knows, I'm a great fan of using M-based typography. In other words, typography that scales nicely in any browser and, you know, can be made larger and smaller by the user to suit their own requirements. Of course, the downside of this approach is it can quickly break designs, especially when the text is contained within some kind of box. Because boxes, you know, in CSS kind of expand naturally vertically, but not so horizontally. The result is you lose all control over line length, and the whole thing feels a bit rubbish, basically. So really, the whole interface should be expanding, including the box itself, and that is what this article tackles, and it's very useful indeed. It's a nice, clean technique that can be used as like a building block for much more complex things. So once you kind of grasp this technique, you should be able to do some really cool stuff and basically make your entire designs expand. So if you're considering doing EMS-based design, then this is a good starting point. So there you go. I think that about wraps up the news for today. We will move on to my special feature.
Bugworld.com.
So, as Marcus said at the beginning of today's show, I'm going to be looking at what you should be learning and concentrating on in 2008. Let's face it, as web designers, we're all busy people, and we work in such a fast-moving sector that it's hard to keep up with everything that's going on, and it's hard to even know what's worthy of our attention. I mean, should we be focusing on Silverlight or brushing up on our JavaScript? Should we be learning Ruby on Rails or grappling with mobile devices? So the idea of today's section is for me to share a few thoughts of where I think things are going to be going in the coming year, and what you should be focusing your energies on. Now, I hate kind of prediction type posts.
I wonder why.
And you get loads of them at this time of year about what's going to happen in the coming year. So I've tried to kind of distance myself a little bit from that by leaving it a couple of weeks and also focusing on what we should be doing rather than what necessarily is going to be happening. Mm. So some of the stuff that I've got in here, you'll go, well, that's not really a prediction. That's happening already. But the point is...
Do everybody talk like that then?
Yeah, they do. The point is that we should be learning this stuff this year rather than it necessarily, you know, so it's already around. There's nothing in here that you probably have never heard of. But I think this is the year where it's going to be more prominent and it's worth taking the time to actually learn about it. Okay, so those disclaimers said, I have five areas that are worthy of your attention. And if you want to ensure that your career stays on track in 2008, then you need to be looking at least some of these. Of course, they're very generic choices and won't apply to every web designer. So if you specialize in this post, this segment probably isn't for you. However, if you're a bit of an all-rounder like me, then it may be relevant. So focus number one. Year on year, we're kind of seeing more and more creative things done at the cutting edge of web design using JavaScript and Ajax and stuff like that. However, despite that, many of us still haven't really kind of become comfortable with JavaScript. We kind of make it do, and we can copy and paste from stuff, and we can kind of work things out, but we don't really know and are not confident in writing JavaScript from scratch. And developers often consider it below them, and designers find it too intimidating. So a lot of us have been avoiding it. And I think until now, we've probably been able to get away with that. By copying and pasting stuff, you can get the certain bits of functionality that you require. And you aren't being asked that often to do anything too complex in JavaScript. However, I think that time's over. And if you don't know JavaScript inside out in 2008, that I think is really going to start to damage your career. And having a good grasp of JavaScript and indeed Ajax will be a requirement as, say, knowing HTML and CSS. So if you're a freelancer, you're going to struggle to fulfill client requirements. And if you're looking for a full-time job, then I think you're going to struggle to find one without knowing JavaScript back to front. So take the time. Learn JavaScript. Okay, focus number two kind of relates to this Web 2.0 phenomenon. Yeah. And I really don't care what anybody else says. I'm pretty convinced that we're in a bubble. In fact, I am convinced we're in a bubble. I lived through the last dot-com boom, and this is another one without any doubt whatsoever. However, the problem with calling it a bubble is that it kind of implies it's going to burst. I don't necessarily think that's going to happen, but I do believe that it's going to slowly deflate like a souffle over the coming year. And so what does that really mean for us as web designers? Well, it could mean very little, or it could mean a hell of a lot, depending on your circumstances. If you work for a Web 2.0 company, either directly or indirectly, in other words, your clients are mainly Web 2.0 companies, then I have to say, if I was you, I would be very afraid. I can see many more companies going under in the coming year, and you could be in a position where you're without a job if you're not careful, or at least losing a lot of work if you work for a lot of Web 2.0 companies. Now, I know that sounds pessimistic, but I do think it is possible. And it gets worse.
And you're all going to die.
Yeah. If, like the majority of us, then you aren't working for Web 2.0 firms, then the effect, okay, may be minimal. But especially, I have to say, if you're an in-house designer or a developer, I think you're probably in a reasonable position. However, if you work for an agency or in a freelancer, then I think you will you will probably see things becoming tougher. At the moment, there aren't enough web designers to fulfill the work out there, and so, you know, there's loads of work around, and we can charge really good rates. Remove the majority of Web 2.0 companies, and suddenly it becomes a more competitive sector. My advice is that that if you're working for a well-established company, then I think you're going to be in a better position. And I think if you're not, you ought to be looking at, you know, for a well-established company, or that you need to build up a really good reputation so you can guarantee work in those tougher times, because I think there are tougher times to come.
I'm not sure I agree with that.
Oh, right. Okay.
For Web 2.0 companies, I might agree with that.
Yeah.
But I think in the kind of whole area of commerce or area of web development, It's minuscule.
I would say that I don't think we're going to clients are going to get scared like they did last time around and stop producing stuff, but there are going to be more web designers after the same amount of work that's currently there.
That's true, but I think the web 2.0 bubble deflating won't affect the amount of work there is out there. I don't think.
No, I'd agree with that. That's what I just said.
Was it?
Yeah.
No, you said that we should all be horribly scared and we're all going to die.
No, I said if you work for a Web 2.0 company, you should be horribly scared. But what I'm getting at is that if you take out the Web 2.0 work that's currently in the industry, that's a whole chunk of web designers that are going to be after non-Web 2.0 type work. Mm. And so that is going to affect companies like us.
Yeah, that's where we disagree. I don't think that it's a big enough sector. I think it'll just dilute into those web designers working will just dilute, and there's still going to be enough work.
Yeah,
maybe me being optimistic.
Yeah, I mean, it might be a geographical thing as well. Yeah. To be fair, if you were on the west coast of America, you might be facing more of a problem.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But then probably not, because it's the richest place in the world, really.
Yeah. So who knows? Okay, you can disagree with me. Anyway, my focus number three. does work on the assumption that times are going to get tougher and competition is going to be more intense. And basically, I don't believe that we're necessarily going to be able to continue to demand the rates that we're currently charging out at, even though Marcus disagrees with me.
No, certainly not.
I certainly
don't agree with that.
Oh, really? Okay. Either way, I think efficiency is going to become king. And I think even with us, we're always looking for ways to become more efficient, aren't
Absolutely.
We?
Absolutely.
Even if, we, you know, to increase our profit margins. Mm-hmm. And I think the agency model, or the service-based model of producing solutions for clients, you know, the margins aren't massive on that. And so efficiency is an important area. So I think whether you believe that things are going to get tougher or not, I think efficiency is going to be a big thing. And we need to work smarter if we're going to, going to continue to make decent money. And although I'm not a great fan of frameworks, I do think they're going to become increasingly important in a competitive environment. Mm. Used right, frameworks allow for speed of production and keep costs down. Whether this means kind of using off-the-shelf frameworks, you know, like the various ones that are knocking around at the moment, or developing them in-house, I don't really know or particularly care. No. Personally, I think from kind of Headscape's point of view, we've always gone for our kind of own in-house frameworks. But that's up to you. However, I think the key is that you need to be as efficient as possible in the way you're building your applications, right, and your HTML and CSS or implementing your JavaScript. So maybe having a bit of a knowledge of some of the frameworks out there is worthwhile. Point number four. But despite my negative predictions, and I do, we will see. I'm a pessimistic person, obviously.
Yeah.
As one door closes, unrealistic Web 2.0 businesses, another opens, and I think that is going to be in the form of the mobile web. Whatever you think of the iPhone and its lack of features, it has stimulated the mobile market, especially when it comes to the mobile web. We're seeing a growing number of competitive devices, all of which have a strong mobile web component. The mobile web offers a massive opportunity for web designers and their careers. With mainstream web design becoming increasingly competitive, the mobile web offers a new frontier where there's far fewer players out there, a much better opportunity to kind of make your mark. Being able to offer your clients mobile web services will start to prove beneficial as the year draws on, and you may even find employers starting to ask for experience in this area when recruiting. Take the time to learn the basics of designing for the mobile web this year. I promise you it will pay off. I think that's a really good one.
I agree with that entirely.
Oh, that's good. Finally, then, I believe that 2008 will be the year that you need to start looking beyond websites. And I guess the mobile web actually is a part of that. For a while now, the bigger players have been pushing their content out beyond the confines of their website. So take eBay, for example. You can view eBay products on your mobile phone, but you can also view them on other sites via widgets and even through desktop applications built with something like Air. And I don't think it's going to be long before the mainstream of website managers and website owners will want the same kind of functionality, and you need to be there to deliver it. Take the time to become familiar with some of the different widgets and desktop standards out there. And I have to say, there are a heck of a lot of them at the moment, and that doesn't make it particularly easy. So if you want to start with something, I'd recommend starting with Air from Adobe, because that means that you can deliver desktop web-based applications to basically any platform. And I believe that being able to build Air applications in 2008 could prove very financially lucrative. And this is something we haven't looked at yet, and I think we probably need to. So there you have it. Obviously, it's not a comprehensive list. Obviously, I'm wrong with half of them, according to Marcus. And this is all very subjective. However, those will be the areas that I'm personally focusing on in 2008. Bugworld.com. Joining me today is Jason Beard, author of an incredibly useful and wonderful book that I've really come to love. That's, how would you describe it? Is it a basic introduction to designing?
It's a basic introduction to graphic design principles. The book was really first intended for web developers. In fact, the initial working title was Web Design for Developers, and it kind of expanded into just a introduction to graphic design principles for anybody, not just developers, not people already creating websites, but anybody interested in design, really.
I mean, what's so great about it is that you kind of really take the time to go over the basic principles of creating a beautiful website, which I guess is the title of the book, is the Principles of Beautiful Web Design. That's the title, isn't it?
That's correct.
I really should have it in front of me, shouldn't I? And, but you've got to be fairly impressed I knew that off the top of my head.
I'm just impressed that you have a copy yourself.
Well, yes, I do. And it's good, because a lot of the people that listen to this show are not necessarily professional designers. So we have a lot of people that listen to the show that are website owners but have to do a bit of design in order to maintain their sites. We've got developers that are developing applications and having to do some design as part of that. And we've also got a lot of kind of people that probably are designers but aren't full-time and so interested about how the professionals go about doing these things. So it's a really good book for the BOAG World listeners, and that's why I've been so desperate to get you on the show for so long, Jason. So it's good to have you.
Sorry for putting you off so long.
Well, you're a busy man, you've got a lot to do. So I thought what we would basically do is take the chapters from the book and maybe pick out some of the basic principles from each of those chapters and get you to talk about them a little bit. So the chapters in your book are layout and composition, color, texture, typography, and imagery. And that, for a start, made me very enthusiastic, because it's like really kind of obvious, basic stuff. Look, here are the main issues you're going to come across from a design perspective. And, you know, we're going to do a chapter on each, which I just thought was very refreshing and very logical and nice. So that's good. So let's kick off with layout and composition. So tell us a little bit about some of the stuff that you cover in that chapter, maybe, and some of the basic principles that non-designers kind of need to know about.
Well, the entire book is really just basics, in my opinion. It's stuff that a lot of people think designers have is intuition, and really it's stuff that you can learn, and learning these principles is like learning how to hand code, really. I mean, you can create a website with a WYSIWYG, but understanding the tags and selectors allows you to, you know, see inside and know what's going on.
Sure.
And these are just basics, but really this is going to be the fire hose version of the book.
Yeah, that's. But, I'm asking you to compress the entire book into about 20, 30 minutes.
I'll give it a shot. To start out with layout, some of the main principles of graphic design theory and gestalt graphic design is balance, unity, and emphasis. And learning how to create all three of those and use them effectively in a layout is a pretty good place to start from a layout perspective. By balance, I mean symmetry. Is it divided right down the middle, or does it still feel balanced even though it's divided into columns? Mm. By unity, I mean, do the elements of the website feel like they're one cohesive thing? You know, does it feel like it's a singular unit rather than a bunch of different bits?
Sure.
Then emphasis, obviously, is about creating a focal point on the page and keeping that focal point and understanding where people are going to look and why they're going to look there. Mm. And so there's different ways to create all three of those things. One thing I talked about in the first chapter about balance and creating balance is divine proportion, which some people call the golden mean or golden ratio. Mm. Really, it's just a rule that if you divide a width by 1.62, it's a number called phi, you get a pleasing proportionate division. And so to make it simpler, that can be known as also the rule of thirds. If you divide something by thirds, that's pretty close to 1 to 1.62 ratio. And you can come up with a pleasing kind of division for, say, a navigation column and a content area by using that kind of division. But really, that's sort of an overview.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder why the rule of thirds work. Did you find out anything in your research about why that is pleasing?
I didn't really find a whole lot of really solid information about it, but there is some out there. The Pythagoreans supposedly noticed that was a very common division in nature, like with things like leaves and shells, and things had the same ratio. And they started developing a concept that anything designed around that is, you know, designing around nature, and therefore designing around God's design. You know, so the Romans and the Greeks built some of their architecture based on the golden ratio, golden mean. And it just has stayed a staple of graphic design since those times.
Yeah, and it really does work. I mean, I remember even, you know, back at art college when I was being taught photography, the same principles apply to photography composition, you know, or really anything you're doing, whether it's print design or web design. So, yeah, the rule of thirds, I think that's a good one to take away.
Yeah.
Okay, what about colour? Tell us a little bit about colour, because, I mean, that's a huge subject that people have written entire books on, and you had one chapter. So so what did you choose to pick out on the subject of colour?
That's the important thing to remember about all these chapters, is that there are entire books dedicated to each chapter of my book. So I feel like I was really just trying to squeeze it already into the book. But with colour, I think the most important thing to remember is that people's perceptions of color depend on their own personal experiences and then cultural traditions. Like, for instance, right now, red and green means Christmas, you know, for most Americans and most people around the globe. Whether they believe in that or not, it's just something that we've been exposed to so much that that's the way we see it.
Yeah.
But beyond those personal perceptions and traditional perceptions, it's good to know that there are ways to combine colors where you really can't make too big of a mistake. And that's using a color wheel and relying on color schemes that exist. With any rule, I mean, it can be broken for whatever purpose you want, but it's good to know what the good, you know, color choices look like before you start making your own. And relying on color schemes and relying on a color wheel is a good way to get started.
I think that's that, you know, when you talk about, okay, there, these rules exist to be broken, I mean, okay, that's true. But for the kind of audience you were trying to reach and, you know, that may be a non-designer audience, kind of playing safe is always quite a good way to go.
And it's true.
Color, yeah, using color wheels and stuff. Don't you also mention in the book about finding a photograph that you like? And or was that somewhere else? That might have been somewhere else. But it's a nice idea anyway. Taking a photograph and extracting the colors from that, I think, is quite a nice way of doing it as well. Have you ever tried that?
I have tried that. I've used that. I use that quite often. I don't know if I mentioned that in the book or not. I mentioned a few other software-based color choosers. And one that came out around the time when I was writing the book that I didn't get a chance to include was Adobe's Color, KULER.adobe.com. That's really a fun, intuitive way to learn color schemes and to play around with color choices. I've actually been using that a lot lately in building color schemes for websites that I'm working on myself.
Yeah, I mean, I think using a tool like that is very handy indeed because, I mean, let's face it, we all perceive color in slightly different ways. And you know, what is it, 1 in 10, is it, or 1 in 20 men are colorblind anyway? So
I believe it's 1 in 10, I think. I have a slight colorblindness, usually red-green, where they can't tell the difference between red and green.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, yes, I think using a tool is a good idea if you're not a designer that's really confident with color. What about the subject of texture? Now, that was an interesting one. I was quite interested that was included in your chapter's listings. And I hadn't really... Well, I kind of intuitively do stuff with texture, but I've never really thought about it that much. So tell us a little bit about why you decided to include that and what advice that you give.
That, for me, was probably one of the hardest chapters to write because it was a lot of intuition, and I liked to use texture a lot in my own designs. Mm. And I think that's really where truly unique design begins. But there's not much principle-wise to it. I mean, you can talk about points and lines and shape, and that's where all visual effects really begin. But texture is really about creating a tactile quality and a theme for your website. Mm-hmm. Whether that be, you know, a smooth shape like, you know, an Apple computer with rounded corners and glossy buttons, or whether that is a wicked worn look with a brick texture or something that makes it look nostalgic or old or whatever feel you want to create, you can do that with texture. And I was trying to just convey that in that chapter.
Yeah, I mean, texture kind of gives the character to the site in many ways, doesn't it? From the kind of grunge look that you get through to the highly reflective look of like you say, sites like Apple. So what kind of, you talked about points and lines, and what do you, perhaps you explain some of those concepts to us.
Well, you can create any kind of visual asset, and you can create any kind of visual effect with just points. I showed an example of a picture of my cat, Abby, created with like a dot matrix printer kind of effect on it.
Okay.
It's just points. And then you can move into using lines and shapes. But it's just important to remember that like lines can create movement. If a horizontal line doesn't have as much movement, say, as a diagonal line, vertical lines, you know, lead you up and down the page. It's important to remember eye movement when you're creating textures. But really, it's just, like I said, about creating a tactile quality and a theme for the website.
So, I mean, as far as people may be, you know, just say a developer that has developed an application and he needs it to look kind of half decent, but doesn't want to do anything too risky in case he screws it up and he's not a designer. I mean, what kind of advice do you give a person like that? Do you encourage them, well, probably best stay away from doing too much textual stuff, or is that something he should get into?
I think it's something that you should think about. Texture can easily be overdone, and it can become, you know, goofy and silly rather than being professional. And I think it's just in moderation using it. The main thing is don't just leave your website as, you know, backgrounds on divs, background colors on divs. You know, create some kind of texture or feel to it, whether that's rounded corners or whether to go with a minimalist look where you know, don't really use background images but rely on negative space. It's just about going beyond just the standard HTML look. I mean, obviously, with style sheets, you can't really just leave it unstyled because, you know, unstyled content is just has no structure to it anymore because we've taken out the tables, we've taken out the design in HTML, and now we're relying on style sheets. So now you really have to build something up. So that's good, I think. It makes people think about texture and all these typography and color and all these elements of design. But just think about it and go beyond just the basics. Or just try to recreate something that you already like, texture-wise. That doesn't mean stealing the design, but looking at another website that you think captures the look and professional look and feel that you're going for and try to recreate that in your own website.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you talk about looking for inspiration. I mean, what kind of advice would you give people about where's a good place to look? Should they just be looking at other websites, or should they be looking beyond the web a bit?
I really believe that people need to look beyond the web. One of the taglines for the sale of this book is that you don't need to go to art school to design great-looking websites. And while I was kind of scared of that tagline that my professors from college would hate me for it, it's really true because if you have a passion for it, you'll draw an inspiration from all sorts of sources, whether it be architecture or goofy things like traffic patterns or a door that you see. You know, anything can really inspire a look or feel to a website. Jonathan Snook recently wrote an article about how he was inspired by an Art Deco building, and that was what gave him the design idea for his current website design.
Yeah. I think that's particularly true when it comes to texture and color as well, that, you know, that you can see textures and colors around you in, you know, everything from a plant pot through to, you know, a magazine. So, yeah.
Right. And one of the other big things about going through a collegiate art program is that if you go to school for graphic design, you're not just learning graphic design. You actually have to take all the traditional art classes, painting, drawing, pottery sometimes, yeah. And you have to take a lot of art history, and the reason for that is to create a foundation of visual exposure to art, you know, so you have this vocabulary and you have this experience pool to draw from when you're creating your own designs.
You mentioned earlier negative space when you were talking about texture, just as another kind of approach to things. Negative space is always something that I think designers throw around. It's a term that we like to use quite a lot, but it's not something we ever really kind of explain. Is it? Just spend a couple of minutes just explaining how negative space works and why it's so important, if you would.
Negative space is important because it allows you to your eye to move around things. If you had a page completely crammed with text, you wouldn't have any focal point to start with except for the top of the page. Our eyes tend to gravitate towards the center of a composition. So if you think about that, then you can have an element that's somewhere around the center of the composition that leads you to another element, say, at the top of the page. Negative space is really just a tool for moving the eye around.
Right.
If you have, like I said before, diagonal lines create movement. If you have diagonal lines that lead you up towards something else, I gave a few examples in the book. It's hard to talk about it without examples.
Yeah, I know. It's frustrating, isn't it? Sometimes I really regret doing an audio podcast. It's a bad choice. Okay, so let's look at the subject of typography. I'm guessing that must have been quite a hard chapter to write because, well, A, typography is a massive subject, and B, typography on the web's quite a tricky area, isn't it? I mean, it's kind of easy to almost, you know, as a non-designer to dismiss typography by going, well, there's only about 4 fonts I'm allowed to use anyway, so therefore, you know, typography on the web doesn't exist.
Right.
Why is that wrong? Why is that not the truth? And how did you squeeze a chapter out of this?
Well, just like all the rest of the chapters, there are a lot of books written on the subject of typography that go way beyond our experience with web or even print graphic design, that go way back into the roots of communication. And that's really what typography is about, is communication. And all websites, you know, you're trying to communicate something. So if you can't do that with pictures and ideas, you have to do that with words. And so the way those words appear to people should become part of your design. And it's kind of hard with the with the state that it's in with the web, having a limited palette of fonts to choose from. But at the same time, it's a good thing, I think, for the novice, because even though we're limited to this certain number of fonts that everybody has on their computers, most of those fonts, aside from maybe Comic Sans, are decent to use for body text and headlines and things like that. Mm. The most important thing is just remember that there are other fonts out there, and to have a sensitivity towards things like the spacing between lines and mm-hmm. Vertical rhythm. The vertical rhythm is something I didn't talk about at all in my book because I thought it was kind of an advanced subject, but right after the book was published, it sort of exploded into a big topic in web design. And there's a lot of great articles out there written by a lot of the web designers about vertical rhythm and how that affects your typography.
So what is vertical rhythm for those that don't know?
Vertical rhythm is just creating a spacing between your lines that kind of matches up throughout the website, so that the spacing in your lines in the navigation areas and the spacing in your lines in the content areas kind of line up, and they're not just randomly spaced apart so you get weird alignments between things. Just creating a vertical rhythm, I mean, in itself is a good description of what it is. Is you're creating a rhythm, a pattern for your eye to follow down the page.
So it's all about basically making sure that typographic elements across multiple columns have some kind of relationship to one another, and that they're not kind of just higgledy-piggledy all over the place.
That's the way I understand it. That's the way I think about it, is that it's really just about creating a pattern and being intentional about the way the text lines up.
So whatever, bearing in mind that, you know, they're limited to quite a small set of fonts, what kind of basic advice would you give to somebody starting off with web typography? I mean, you've mentioned line spacing. What are you getting at there?
The default line spacing for HTML is very tight, and it's with tight text like that, it's kind of hard to read. And also thinking about the width of the type that you're reading. When you're reading a magazine article or a newspaper article, the reason why the columns are so narrow is because it's easy, or a book even, it's easy for your eye to scan a certain width of text. And it's easy for your eye to move to the next line if there's a little bit of space between it. And if you kind of know those basic concepts, then you can, you know, make it a little more pleasing to read than the default setup for typography on the web.
Yeah, because especially if you've got a fluid site, you can end up with ridiculously long line lengths if you want.
Right, and that's, I think, a lot of the beef that people have with fluid layouts is that not only are you taking power from the graphic designer, but you're also making line widths that may be incredibly hard to read. Mm. But in my opinion, it's, if the user is comfortable expanding the site out to that width to read the line width that long, then obviously they don't have a problem with it. But so you should sort of leave that up to the user if you can. But it's been proven that it's easier to read text that's set to a certain width. Hmm.
Are there certain typefaces that are better suited to kind of headings or in preference to body and vice versa?
Well, with body text, and traditionally, it used to be that body text for books and things like that were set in times or serif fonts because the serifs sort of lead your eye to the next character. But because of the resolution level we have with monitors, and because of the way that the text is being presented, it's actually been proven that sans serif fonts like Arial and Helvetica are easier to read in smaller sizes because you don't get the kind of resolution, you don't get the kind of detail that you get with printed type. And now that's changing. I mean, we're getting higher and higher resolution displays, so maybe that will change in the future. But it's just important to know that those kind of ideas when you're choosing the body type for your website. But when you're choosing a heading, when you've got something that's very large, it really just matters how the text displays. And you can, because you can use images or you can use things like Cipher to display another font besides the standard, you know, six or seven fonts that are available. I call it the OK Fine 9 that are available to across Mac and web computers, Mac and PC computers. You can choose other fonts that are outside of those fonts to use for your headers and for areas where you want to give a little more design appeal. So there's a world of fonts out there, some good, some corny, that are available, some free and some very expensive, that you can use for, you know, the headlines on your website. And it's just important to be aware of those other fonts. I give a few resources for free fonts. I like 1001fonts.com. It's a good place to go for licensed fonts. Emigre is a great font foundry. There's just a lot of great font makers out there that make excellent fonts, not just for printed material like books and things, but that web designers and people working on the web should be aware of as well.
Cool. So the last chapter in your book talks about imagery. And I'm fascinated. I have to confess, I haven't read that chapter yet. So I'm kind of fascinated to know what you cover in that chapter as far as using imagery on the web. What kind of advice do you give?
Well, imagery, the graphic design doesn't stop with creating the frame around, you know, the website. It's also about formatting the inside, which is kind of difficult when you give the power to the user, give them content management. But choosing supporting content imagery is one thing that can really enhance the user experience of the website. Mm-hmm. And finding or creating supporting imagery for website content can be really difficult if you don't know where to look or if you're not a good illustrator or if you're not good at Photoshop. I mean, so I just try to give a basic primer on finding this type of supporting imagery and if you find an image that might work, how to tweak it to work for your needs. Right. I just wanted to kind of give a basic intro to using stock photo sites like iStockPhoto or Stock Exchange, which is sxc.hu.com. sxc.hu is the address of it. It is a free stock photography site that's really great and has a lot of images. Finding images and then using them in your site is one way to really just enhance the experience for the user. Beyond that, I also tried to warn people to avoid stealing images from Google and to avoid the cliched stock images and stock photography that we're all used to seeing in most free publications. Because really, a lot of stock images that have been created, you know, the guy with the light bulb above his head, you know, holding the hands holding the tree that's growing out of the soil in the person's hands. These are like big cliches in the stock photography world. You kind of have to be aware of when you're choosing images, but it's important to choose images that enhance the content.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, did you cover any kind of the technical aspects of kind of compressing images and whether to go GIF or JPEG and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I did give a primer on that about JPEGs, GIFs, and PNGs, and just as like a quick for everybody, if you're using a photo, you obviously want to use JPEG because usually with photos, you have a lot of different tones and images, and GIFs and PNGs are the file sizes based on the number of colors in the image. If you're using, say, an icon type thing or a color field where you've got a limited number of colors, then GIFs or PNGs are the way to go. And choosing between GIF and PNG is really just about choosing between the type of transparency you want to have. Internet Explorer 6 and below doesn't support alpha transparency, where you have sort of a gradient from opaque to transparent. It just supports on and off. So with pings, if you have transparency in them, you get a pink halo around them. You know, areas where there's transparency, you can't see. Now, there's fixes for that, but they're kind of hacky still. And for that reason, people still hang on to the good old GIF format, which has transparency and unfortunately also has animation.
So is that one of your rules, never ever use animated GIFs?
Actually, no, it's not, because I've used animated GIFs even on my own site. If you go to jasongraphics.com and you hover over the logo, it was sort of an experiment, a toy to play with when I was designing my current layout. It's a sliding doors type image where I've got the still part of the JSON Graphics logo, and then when you move over it, it jumps up the position of the image jumps up, so you see the animated moving like sun rays above the logo. So that's an animated GIF, and I'm not ashamed of that, but I think that animated GIFs in a lot of ways degrade the professionalism of a lot of websites.
I mean, that's a really... It sounds like a superb book, basically, for anybody that's kind of not from a design background. Where can they get hold of a copy? Where can they find out more about it? You know, how can they buy it, I guess? That's the next question.
Well, I'd love for you to buy it.
obviously.
But I set up a little promo website for the book called just principlesofbeautifulwebdesign.com, where you can kind of hover over the things. I did a fun little thing where if you hover over each of the chapter names, it sort of points out in the website design itself how those things play a part of each of the part of the design that I made for the promo site itself. Beyond that, Amazon.com has a good price in the book usually, and you can go to, of course, SitePoint.com to buy directly from them. And that's what a lot of people prefer to do, is buy directly from SitePoint. Because they send you lots of emails about books that are coming up and specials, and just a lot of people are big fans of SitePoint. I really like them a lot too.
Yeah, if you haven't checked out SitePoint before, then it's worth saying that they're a lot more than a book publisher. They've got a huge site with tons of great articles on all aspects of web design. Really active forum there as well. There's really
the forums are a great place to get involved and a great place to learn new things.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Jason, for coming on the show. I can't say I normally get people in just to pimp their book. And to be honest, that wasn't what I originally asked you to do either. But the more I've kind of thought about it, the more I've looked at it, the more I think this is just a perfect book for a lot of the people that are listening to this show. And if you're starting out on any form of design and you don't come from a design background, then I can highly recommend this as a book to check out. Jason, we'll get you back again in the future, no doubt, to maybe cover some of these things in more depth. But for now, thank you very much for your time.
I appreciate being on the show. It's like being on the David Letterman or Conan O'Brien of web development. Or sort of like a status symbol, like having a happy webby made of you. But I'm just glad to be here, and thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks very much. Bugworld.com.
Okay, well, we're going to finish off this week with our new bit. Listeners' emails.
And thankfully, people did write in. I was beginning to get a bit nervous.
Yeah, thank you very much. We've had lots.
Yeah, we did in the end.
Which is great.
Mm-hmm.
We've even had some audio ones, of which we'll play one in a minute. But the first one, this is from Robin. I'm a part-time web developer committed to web standards. One day, I'd like to make it my job. I'm a regular listener to Boag World in my car, going to work in the traffic jam. Remembering your discussion with Marcus about wireframing, PowerPoint or Visio, I just came across this project. I can't talk. Product. www.axure, which is axure.com. Demo.aspx, but I'm sure not just the axure.com will do. Looks spectacular, although much too expensive for me. Still, keep up the good work.
And it looked very good. I went to have a look at it, and I've got to say, that is the way to do wireframing. If you know, it was a very impressive product. I don't have internet access here, so I can't pull up how much it actually was, and I can't remember off the top of my head. But definitely worth a look. Now, I think it was Windows only, as I remember, which is why I didn't actually download it and try it.
Oh, right, okay. But I'll have a look at it then.
Yeah, go and have a look.
Axia.
It's, you know, it's definitely worth a play with, let's put it like that. Okay. So thank you for that, Robin. Yes,
thank you. Our next question is an audio question from Sultan.
Hi, Paul and Marcus. Quick question. On your portfolio on Headscape, I see related links, related pages underneath the thumbnails, and I was wondering what's the logic in that, and also why when I click on the thumbnail to get the bigger version, why didn't you guys link those sites to the actual sites? If it's to keep them from going off-site and into Never Never Land, I understand that as well. But I was wondering, is there a benefit or loss in either one of those two things, having the related links, related pages, and or the screenshots that don't actually link to the actual websites? Thank you.
Well, yes, the Headscape site is fairly rubbish at the moment.
Yeah. it's not rubbish. Mm. That's a bit harsh. But it's a little bit dated. And I think, you know, we did it a while ago now, and you never get round to upgrading your own website. And there are some things on the site I really like still, and there are some things that I really don't. And one example of things that I'm not sure work very well is this kind of related pages, related links. The kind of logic was that related pages referred to kind of other pages on the same website. So, you know, if you're in the services section and you're reading about our usability stuff, then you can go through to some case studies that explain it. Well, related links were kind of linking to external sites, you know, on third parties. And although this kind of sounds like quite a good idea,
we were trying to create a convention all of our own. And it didn't work.
And, you know, I think it made sense to us, but I don't necessarily think it makes sense to everybody else. So it probably needs changing, and it's not a big job to change it, but I never get round to it. And, yeah, it's terrible, isn't it? Your own website's bottom of the heap. But we are going through a rebranding exercise at the moment, and that will force us to do our own website. Quite.
And I've never liked the fact that you can't link through to the websites from the portfolio section. But there are good reasons why not.
Yes, there are good reasons why. I am fairly happy with the portfolio section. And although I do take on board that it's always good to link out to the actual ones, we've got several reasons for the decision to link to screenshots rather than to live sites. And these include that some of the sites that we produce are intranets and so aren't publicly available. Some sites have got limited shelf lives, so are no longer actually online. And we wanted the users to be able to click through a series of them in quick succession. So you can just click, click, click and see one after another, which you obviously can't do if you're going off to third-party sites. And also with this kind of mix of different stuff, with some stuff being available, some stuff not, I like a consistent user experience. I don't like the idea of, well, this one goes off to a live site and this one's a screenshot. It just felt a bit messy.
I think they should all go to screenshots, but you should be able to click on the screenshot
to go off to the site. Quite possibly, actually.
It's just one of those things that you think, I wish it did that, and then I forget about it because I've moved on.
I mean, however, I think the primary reason is that, let's face it, with the majority of our clients, we hand over code and designs to them, and we provide content management systems and stuff like that. So they make significant alterations to the sites that we deliver. And at the end of the project, we simply can't guarantee the quality of the design and code. And whether it will be maintained to the same standards we've kind of established.
You're also pointing people back at big projects that we did 4 or 5 years ago, which are, you know, you might not want people to look under the hood of, maybe.
Yeah.
But still, that's a little bit short-sighted in my view.
Yeah, I know. There is no right or wrong answer to it, but I do think it kind of works for us, and, you know, we've never had any major complaints about it, so I guess, you know.
Yeah. But you might just be, we might be sending people away, Paul.
I know, but that's true of any decision you make. I'm sticking by this decision. Although I would agree that with some of them, it would be nice to put in links. Yeah. There's no reason why we couldn't. There's no reason other
it's
than
just
we're
pure
too
lazy.
Damn lazy.
Nothing other than laziness.
Exactly. So that about wraps up the show, I believe.
I thought, seeing it's my last show, I ought to do a good joke.
It's not your last show. Just accept it, Marcus.
Yeah, I'm flying to America next week.
It's not going to happen.
Oh, okay. I can't, actually, because my passport's run out.
Yeah. Really. And why, if you think it's your last show, have you booked to go to South by Southwest?
I'm just going
to
go have a jolly with you guys. And there's a music festival afterwards.
By the way, talking about South by Southwest, Great British Booze Up has been booked again this year.
Yes, good point, yes.
Which is very, very exciting.
I'm going. I'm down. I'm...
And it's an official event this year. It's actually appearing in the magazine and stuff.
What night is it? What night did we do it last year? I can't remember.
Let me have a look at my calendar.
I think we did Monday.
Let's see. Great British. And apparently it's not in my calendar. That's a lie. British. Booze.
Up.
There it is. It's on the 10th of March. It's going to be at Shakespeare Pub.
Monday.
It's the Monday.
Yeah.
So it should be good. I'm really looking forward to it. And the fact that it's an official event, extra special. In return for that, we're supposed to say lots of nice things about South by Southwest. And they gave us this official blurb we were supposed to read out.
Well, you better keep talking then, because they didn't select my one.
No, because you're bitter about it. But
But now I'm thinking, great, I don't have to do anything.
South by Southwest, is it not the most exciting conference you can go to?
I enjoyed it very much last time.
It's very, very cool. So I'm not going to read the official blurb. I'm going to rebel, making the presumption nobody ever actually listens to this podcast anyway. and certainly not the people that arrange South by Southwest.
We've got 4 people from Headscape going this year.
I know, it's going to be cool. Oh, yeah, I forgot that. Mm. Yeah, unfortunately, they're sitting next to us on the plane. out of everything, can we?
No.
Can we not book separate planes or anything?
But they've had to book a hotel that's about 300 miles from the conference centre.
Well, we're right nearby. So, yeah, that's going to be really exciting. But that's really not relevant yet because it's not Well, I suppose January.
It's not that far away.
It's not that far. Beginning
Six
of March.
Weeks, isn't it? 7 weeks, maybe.
So, yeah. I haven't prepared my presentation yet.
laughed,
I'm really quite nervous
maniac.
About that. Luckily, mine, the British Booze Up is going to happen after my presentation, so I'll be relaxed by that point.
Oh, yeah.
And I've got new Moo cards coming. By the way, thank you guys for all this. Oh, some really funny stuff. I'll bring them next show.
Read them out next
I'll
week.
Bring them in and we'll have a look through some of them.
Excellent. Right, shall I read this good joke?
Yeah, go on then.
Thank you, Ian.
Oh, it's Ian again. Ian, is he the only person that sends you jokes, or is he the only person that sends you as your sense, your twisted sense of humour?
Yes.
To both.
No, to the second one, definitely. Right, here we go. Dad is in his workshop in the basement when little daughter arrives and asks the dreaded question, Dad, what's sex? Dad starts sweating but realises this is one he cannot evade, and it's time he faced up to it. So he composes himself, makes some space near a chair and sits her down. Very seriously, he starts describing all there is to know about the birds and the bees, human anatomy, all the gory details, etc., etc. Dad has now gone all sweaty and red with embarrassment, but at least he's got it all off his chest. He notices the daughter looks very puzzled. What's wrong, my dear? He asks. Well, Mummy said dinner will be ready in a couple of secs.
That, it would be funny, except you don't say it like that. So actually, the whole joke is fundamentally flawed, Ian. I'm sorry.
I love it. It's
perhaps it's an...
But you know that I actually don't... I like kind of poor jokes, really.
Yeah, you do.
Which
you,
is why I like, you know...
That is one of the Moo cards. Truly crappy jokes. So there you
well,
go.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, thank you very much for listening to the show. I hope you enjoyed it, and we will be back again next week.
Maybe.
Marcus will be back again next week, being all crestfallen and depressed.
Yeah.
And he'll be doing the feature as well on how to fail as a pop star.
I was looking for it.
Yeah, there you go. All right, talk to you soon. Goodbye.